Welcome to Macrowedge Radio. Please note that the content aired on this program is intended strictly for entertainment and educational purposes only and does not constitute financial, legal, or professional advice. The opinions, discussions, and views expressed by our contributors, guests, and associated Macrowedge staff are their own and do not necessarily represent the official stance, strategy, or opinions of the Macrowedge organization or any of its affiliates. While we strive to provide accurate and up-to-date information, Macrowedge Radio makes no representation or warranties of any kind expressed or implied about the completeness, accuracy, reliability, suitability, or availability of the content of this show. Any reliance you place on such information is therefore strictly at your own risk. We do not endorse or assume responsibility for the accuracy or reliability of any information offered by third-party websites, linked through the show, or any website or feature linked in any banner or other advertising. We will not be a party to or in any way be responsible for monitoring any transaction between you and any third-party providers of products or services. All audio content of Macrowedge Radio is the intellectual property of the Macrowedge organization, and any use, reproduction, or redistribution of this content without the express written consent of the Macrowedge organization is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Macrowedge After Dark. It's been an interesting week. This is edition number 11. We're going to talk about everything that is going on in the markets. We're going to have sort of a macroeconomic smorgasbord, for lack of a better word, because we want to sit there and look at everything that is going on in the market. And there is a lot going on in the markets and in the economy as a whole. If one pays attention to what has been occurring, the drama on the social media side versus what's occurring in the real economy and what has happened to our nation in the last 2 weeks is amazing. So let's start with one thing that I'm going to open the show with, because you're going to hear a lot about this. This is the theme for the election in 2024, and it has nothing to do with either candidate. They're both participants in making it what it is, and this is not some pronouncement or announcement that I'm going to sit there and say, hey, we have to sit there and start taking socialists' viewpoints to make things happen. This is the reality of what's occurring. A little historical fact: in 1935, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was shocked. Absolutely shocked to learn that 5% of the wealthy in corporations controlled or owned 87% of the assets. What would FDR think about Democrat President Biden and the 1% controlling 95% today? Folks, we're not in a situation of wealth inequality. We're in a situation of twisting capitalism out of its original foundation and turning it into a government partnership, which has distorted markets, distorted reality, and distorted the value of the dollar to a point now where it's the most valuable currency in the world for now, only because we encouraged everyone to get in debt using the dollar as long as we have been in power. I'm going to read a little X posting from somebody on via Wall Street Apes. I didn't see this until right before the show. It's from May 3rd of this year. I'm on Social Security, 68 years old, working just to pay my taxes. My property taxes were $895 a year. Now my property taxes are approaching $8,000 a year over the last couple of years, and so we're paying $700 a month to rent to the state to live in our own house. Problem is that I'm 68 years old. There needs to be a moratorium on what we have to pay. I worked the entire winter up on that mountain for $6,500 just to pay my property taxes because I'm stubborn enough. I don't want to dig into my bank account to pay them. It's like, well, you want me to work. Well, I'll work. And I'm 68 years old, and I'll work all summer. Most of my time is just to pay my property taxes to live in the house that I bought in 1995. When my children are raised, they want to get married there, and I plan on being there till the very end. We just can't take this anymore. This was a great place and still is, but the people that made it great can't afford to live here anymore. Now, that's not an attack on what's occurring in our system, because it's nationwide. In Florida, I'm witnessing it now, and everyone's saying, oh, there's not really a bust in Florida occurring. Oh, yeah, there's a bust occurring in Florida. You just haven't heard about it because it hasn't made the mainstream media yet in any large volume. You're hearing about the high housing prices and now all of a sudden the massive number of listings. Anybody can go to Zillow, put in a county, Sarasota, Orange, Osceola, Broward, Miami-Dade. You'll see the number of homes for sale. You can watch the prices yourself, ticking up and ticking down, rolling over. In my area, we have a great place called Lakewood Ranch. It was the boom place. A lot of wealthy people retired, moved down here. Now they're seeing what happened after one hurricane years ago came close to the area, raised the insurance rates, caused an imbalance. Property taxes have gone up because valuations have gone up, also putting pressure on property insurance rates. HOA fees have gone up. We're watching what happens with people who have fixed incomes who bought homes decades ago now are being forced to sell, forced sellers. But they're being forced to sell into a market with 6.5% to 7.5% mortgages on a long-term 30-year mortgage. And the qualifications are getting more difficult. The people who have the 550 to 650 credit scores, they're not going to get in as easy. And that's eventually going to cause the real estate to pile up. It's a buyer's market now. And what that individual who I read from that posting from Wall Street Apes from long ago, as a reminder, should stick in your mind that when this crashes, it's not going to be like 2008. And I'm beginning to think it's going to be more like 1981, an inflationary crash where we see the inflation or stagflation of that era, shall we say, peak out, roll over, embed itself in the economy until someone finally decides to pull the plug on it. So far, there are no adults in the room. And as a consequence, speculation is running rampant. This week in the markets, the Dow finished at 38,589. A little bit down for the week, no big deal. S&P 500, 54.31, up for the week. Flat since Wednesday, however. The NASDAQ 17,688, it's on its own planetary trajectory. It's doing whatever it wants to do because of the big set, the Magnificent Seven. And let's be quite honest about it. The Russell 2000 is the one to watch because it's starting to indicate the true economic undercurrents that we're witnessing. The small caps were flat for the week, but it spiked up in the middle of the week on the hopes of interest rate cuts and all the nonsense from the Fed, then went back down and flat for the week. And the whole trend for the entire week, which I was shocked. We had bad advanced decline days every day. We had bad new high, new lows every day. I mean, when you have you're making record highs, but more new lows, more decliners, there's something wrong underneath the surface of the market. And the volume has been akin to the week after Christmas type volume. Very bad summer volume, even though we're not near a holiday. Granted, we have a holiday and a closure next Wednesday, but we're not in the holiday period, so to speak. So if you go through all of this and you review what's happening, there's a liquidity problem approaching. You no longer have the stock buyback periods. They're going into their blackout period beginning today at the close of the market. There will be no more buybacks. There will be no more announcements of buybacks. It will be a long-term problem for this market as these blackouts appear. You are also going to witness, to my shock, liquidity problems possibly in the bond market. From Reuters today, bond traders worry liquidity will worsen as U.S. market size grows. They're worried about that because the amount of debt we're issuing on a weekly basis, monthly basis, and the deficits that are growing. And what's killing everyone is we're still issuing more short-term debt versus long-term debt. I don't understand the theory. They had a chance to issue. It was Janet Yellen's ultimate blunder to not issue 10 and 20 and 30-year debt when it was 2.5%. Instead, it's almost as if they plan to sabotage the economy 5 years from now because people aren't worried about liquidity for the Treasury market. There's always a buyer of last resort known as the Federal Reserve, and they will intervene and they will force the market makers, the bond marketers to buy that. They have no choice. The problem is if the foreigners start to abandon the Treasury options, as has been indicated from Asia, it will start to creep in and cause problems for everyone. Moving on, gold, 2348, still trading within the range. As long as it stays between 2250 to 2450, it's going to stay in that range. This consolidation will probably stay in its place throughout the summer, along with silver, 2962. It'll probably stay between 26 and 32, 33. That will probably last until August, barring a geopolitical event. Once the consolidation is over, I got a feeling they're going to break out to the high end because of the political instability that I think is going to be inherent in the United States come after Labor Day. Crude oil is at $78.49, Brent at $82.67. Citigroup came out this week and predicted a $60 price target, except geopolitics once again could interfere with that. There is a good argument for that. There is an excess of oil. We've had a great consolidation of the various participants in the Bakken region and in South Texas. We could see oil easily collapse if everybody starts cranking up production to its maximum. And if Trump wins the White House, we're going to go ahead and push for that and try to get oil overproduced, even though we're the largest producer in the world. Next up, I want to hit this AI story. Everybody's been talking about AI. I have to say, folks, this is a lot of old-time 1999-ish flashbacks for a lot of us. We were told that the internet was the greatest thing in the world. And yes, it is, and it was. Unfortunately, what's happening now is we're looking at AI as this solution, when in fact it's just a basic small chunk of software which has not conclusively proven to be viable in the business arena. From the register, the A register. Payoff from AI projects is visible, business leaders complain. Between April and May of 2024, LucidWorks conducted a survey of business leaders involved in AI adoption in North America, EMEA, and the APAC region. The respondents, exclaimed, were drawn from 1,000 companies with 100 or more employees across 14 industries, all of which have said they've had active AI initiatives underway. 23% are executives, 6% are managers, and 86% involved in technology decision making. 39% of the participants hailed from North America, 36% from Europe and the Middle East, and 24% from the APAC region. According to the results of the survey, 63% of global companies plan to increase spending on AI in the next 12 months, compared to 93% in 2023 when LucidWorks conducted its first investigation. The biggest problem, they're not seeing any viable economic results, financial benefit to integrating it within their companies. And it's very obvious if you see it, if you've encountered it in the real world. It's just as the same as when the internet was first introduced. We saw Netscape, we saw AOL, we saw all these companies come alive. Everyone thought, yeah, this is going to be great. We're going to have broadcasting, video, talk, replace the telephone, et cetera, et cetera. But it took a decade plus for it to become viable, and it took smartphones with widespread Wi-Fi availability and high-speed streaming to turn the internet into this giant monster that it is today that has replaced a lot of the previous commercial ventures, like radio, like television. We wouldn't be here right now talking on social media without it. AI is in the same place as the internet was in 1998. I beta tested the Roadrunner. We were lucky enough, my wife and I were living in a place in Tampa, and they came by and said, hey, would you like to test this for us? Sure, we had no idea what high-speed internet was. I'm sitting here with my dial-up begging for something better. They hook it up. It was fantastic. We saw the future. The problem is the software wasn't up to the speed of the high-speed internet at that time. At this time, AI is not up to the task because it's still subject to the whims, political, emotional, and personal beliefs of the programmers. It's not an independently thinking object or organism which can develop its own rational, logical conclusions because people are interfering with it, injecting their own ideals into the system, which I think is going to be one of the biggest drawbacks for artificial intelligence for the next 2 to 5 years. And until that's cleared out of the system, I don't see an evolution that will be practical for most businesses. With that being said, I'd like to bring Mr. Awesome up to bat. It's time to sit there and hear someone else's voice and hear their opinions. I'd like to get a quick opinion. I just read something that JCPenney's, which was taken over by the great mall powers, to save it, Brookfield and Simon Property Group, they're closing 4 stores. I thought that once that these stores were bought out and integrated into the malls, they could save them. Mr. Awesome, what do you think of that? Are you there, sir?
I am. How are you doing?
Pretty good, sir. Pretty good.
Good. Good question. I think that if any group is positioned to be able to assist JCPenney's, it's Simon Property Group. But I think both Simon and Brookfield have shown that they have some stresses of their own, not just with tenants, but with some of their malls that are handing keys back on loans, and they are struggling for refinancing on some of them as well. So I don't think they're without issues, but they're two groups that definitely are going to put the metal, so to speak, into what they do to save their business.
What do you make of this situation, though? Retail is showing more cracks. Dollar Tree trying to spin off Family Dollar. Fast food chains abandoning California in droves are going bankrupt, just outright bankrupt. We're seeing something locally, and I've seen it in my travels throughout Western and Central Florida, bank branches closing all over the place, which is logical. I don't argue with the principles behind that. But when you see this much empty commercial real estate starting to hit the market, at some point that has to impact the market. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Much like you were discussing the supply of housing, the supply of vacant space begins to drive values and costs down, especially in the retail environment with shopping malls. Once you start losing a lot of your tenants, you start to get fewer foot traffic through. It's something that malls have been fighting for the last 20-plus years. They've gone through some really rough times, and they're definitely hitting that patch again. So I think we're probably going to see more stress in that, especially in the large shopping center categories, and we're probably going to see some more retailers struggle as well, especially as unemployment ticks up, which with the employment situation that came out this week. It's my personal opinion that we're definitely looking at unemployment rates on a year-over-year change basis that indicates we might actually be in recession right now.
Well, I'm going to follow up with that because that's what my piece this week. And if you're not subscribed to Ozone, that's macroedge.net, Ozone. I write for it every Sunday night and occasionally for the Red Eyes. Folks, what I'm looking at now is a lot of people are under this misnomer that it's a slow crawl into a recession, that things don't suddenly collapse. I disagree with that, Mr. A, and Ulysses, I'll tell you why I say that. We witnessed it in 80-81. We witnessed it in 2000, and we witnessed it again in 2008. Things are chugging along, and all of a sudden, straight down. I mean, just instant gravity to markets, to pricing, to everything. And I'm concerned we're approaching that kind of situation, probably made worse by this particular political environment our country's in. What happens when you hit that wall in this kind of economy with interest rates not in an ideal position, a government unprepared to deal with it, and a public which thinks that no matter what happens, no matter what decisions they make in life, they will be able to sit there and get bailed out by the government, be it state or federal?
Yeah, I think that to your first point, the more unemployment increases, the more difficult it's going to get all around the board. As unemployment rises, the economic situation worsens for everybody, right? I don't know the exact statistic, but, it's been referenced even in pop culture, there's a Big Short, but for every 1,000 people that become jobless, there's a portion of them that wind up dying. So there's a lot of economic implications here. And to your other point, with unemployment, other industries that aren't affected necessarily, right? Tech, we saw a big layoff last year. We didn't see a lot of other industries affected, but we're now starting to see that. And our industries are interconnected. We're a consuming nation. So if one group can't consume from the other industries, then it's kind of a self-fulfilling loop. And now we've got the situation where, you're right, interest rates, I don't think we're going to see the interest rate drops that we have in the past. I think that we're in a situation where our nation needs to be able to sell treasuries, and I don't think that reducing rates is going to stimulate anyone to do that. And I think that's, we're seeing some stresses from low-yielding treasuries with banks, and we're starting to see stresses in some of the mortgage markets as well. So it's a really difficult place that we're going to be in. If we can't lower rates much, we don't have the typical tool to reset the economic cycle and borrowing cycle. And we've got election year, you know, in tow. So those are things that are unknowns, right? I can't say who's going to get elected, but I can say from everything that I see, there's a lot of discomfort in the markets, you know, from an everyday basis. Maybe not in the way everybody trades stocks, but certainly in how businesses are operating, earnings, they're laying people off because it's a way that they can reduce cost.
Well, dealing with it from the supply chain perspective, I can tell you right now that everyone is only buying enough to survive for 30 to 60 day outlooks. I'm sure. Witnessing it across the board. No one is going out on a ledge and saying, send me a 6 month supply of X, Y, or Z. And that's a terrifying time from my perspective professionally, but also when you look when manufacturers start telling you, we have no foresight into the next year. We can't even set a business plan up because we can't predict what the consumer or the government is going to do. And I haven't seen that in a very long time.
Agreed. To your point, I just posted some charts, both the durable manufacturing sales revenue, the year-over-year change, and the non-durable manufacturing sales revenue year-over-year change in the spaces. And the majority of each one of these subsectors of industry has seen revenue decline, and that includes things like not new orders, fewer sales. So this is, you know, sales revenue, operations, income. This is from the quarterly financial report that was released on Monday. So we're looking at the majority of American industries on a year-over-year negative sales basis. And then I posted a couple employment charts. One is the year-over-year change in the U3 employment rate. And we've got levels of unemployment change year-over-year that there have never been false alarms reach the level that we've had at this point or extend above it. And we certainly haven't had them for the duration that we do. And then I also posted another chart comparing the unemployment rate and the 10-year Treasury inversion cycles. And we've got an inversion of either the 10-year 3-month or the 10-year minus the federal funds rate. Combined with 4% or more unemployment, it's the start of recession.
I'm going to agree with you. I think upon review, if we can ever get the NBER and BEA to get honest about what is occurring, the recession started sometime in May or April of this year. Now, I'm of the opinion that we're going to see a rotating cycle of mini recessions that last anywhere from 2 to 6 months that hit the economy. We get a little bit of growth. It rolls back over again the next quarter. As long as we have a stagflationary event underway, that's what's worrying me, is that we're going to see inflation stay close to 3.5 to 5%, and at the same time, growth moderate in the 1 to 1.5% range, and that is not a healthy market for anyone. I don't care who you are.
Yeah, I would concur with not being a healthy market. There's definitely the possibility there for rolling recessions. I also think that we're probably going to see more revisions in our HOA. I know we discussed when Yellen first said that there might be revisions to GDP. My thought was revisions downward, and that's exactly what we wound up getting, was a downward revision to GDP for quarter one, and there are going to be subsequent revisions, which I think we might see that we actually went negative. I definitely think it's possible that we went into recession end of last year or first quarter this year. Time will tell. There's, you know, more than just the unemployment and the GDP to it, at least for the Enver dating, but you're right. There's some ugly possibilities if recession is indeed here and or picks up steam.
I think you're right. And we're starting to see hints from the auto industry, the abandonment of the EV experiment. It was a poorly conceived idea. Let the market decide instead of the government. Now we're seeing the price of it and the cost of it with Tesla, despite its product being superior to most of the manufacturers, now being a victim of its own success, where Hyundai and Kia are starting to catch up to with more affordable EVs. and the ability to sit there and set their own charging stations up parallel or using the Tesla network. It's a complicated mess that they've created for that particular industry. But then you take the ICE engines and you add that to the mix, and you see what's happening to the automakers. They all went in on the bet of perpetual cheap oil. I don't think our economy is structured for $3.59, $4, $5 gasoline on a perpetual basis, nor high utility costs for EV charging, et cetera, nor for high costs of insurance, waste disposal, water, et cetera. This is not being captured by the CPI properly. It's not being captured as we saw this week in the data. In fact, I know people find this hard to believe. They think that their health insurance went down in price if you believe the consumer price index. And Mr. A, I got to ask you, you're seeing this reflected in everything, but they say homeowners insurance isn't that big of a factor, but you pay it every month. You look at the various costs of just owning a home, and some people are spending as much on the outside costs, maintenance, insurance, et cetera, escrow, as they are on the payments. You can't. It's not sustainable.
I agree 100%. Those are additional pressures that homeowners are facing across the country. Some areas, they're facing it to a larger degree. But when you have values go up, even let's take out storm situations so we can remove the idea of hurricanes in Florida, or we can remove the idea of fires and earthquakes in California. When the value of something increases at a rapid pace and the insurer needs to cover any potential damages, they're going to reevaluate the charge, their risk-reward profile, in order to cover that appropriately. So even, let's say, up here in Minnesota, where we're not going to have the extreme weather, aside from a couple months out of the wintertime, that Florida and California are experiencing, but we're going to get the apportioned charge for the increase in replacement costs or repair costs that goes along with your automobile, with your home, with your business. So insurance is an enormous part of it. And then, of course, you've got the tax increase as well, right? There's not many taxing locales that are interested in reversing property taxes unless and until they need to. So every opportunity that the town gets to raise funds from increased property taxes, we've seen it. It's just a historical fact. And now if you start adding in increased energy costs, you're right. You're talking about increases to what were not considered maybe for some people in acquisition or for people that have even been comfortable in their homes for a long time, sudden rapid increases in the cost of owning and maintaining homes and automobiles. That affects everybody differently, but there's pressure there. Especially on the lower half of America.
I think one thing else that people are considering way too much as a viable indicator for the economy is Jay Powell's preachings after the FOMC meetings. If you listen to the press conference, you can tell it's highly scripted. Yes, there are some legitimate questions being asked, but a lot of it is, hi, what color tie did you wear, Mr. Powell, when you made this decision? And that is obvious by the softball questions that are tossed up by the mainstream. When you look under the hood of the FOMC meetings, you're beginning to realize, especially if you read their background papers, they have absolutely no clue, because the modeling they are using is based off the Great Financial Crisis. They're basing all of their modeling on an event that occurred 15 years ago, 16 years ago. It actually started in 2006, if you're going to be honest, and are refusing to sit there and change it in anticipation of the shift, be it demographics, be it in the quality of job creation, and the cost of goods and services to be delivered to the consumer. I think they're missing the boat there, and I think it's going to become an expensive mistake for everyone.
It's definitely possible. I am sort of the opinion that I think they're waiting for asset prices to come down, and that's the reason why we've held rates where we have. I don't think that they look at the CPI the same way that all of us do, but that's based on my study of mortgage market cycles And you're right, there's a lot that occurred that they're studying from GFC that isn't necessarily applicable. One thing that I think that they are doing in an attempt to replicate that risk, they're looking at private lending right now and the private credit space. For the last year, the New York Federal Reserve has been doing risk modeling to see where cross contagion can go from private lending to banks. And they have been concerned about that. And they're going to be publishing a series of studies on Monday, starting Monday, based on that. So I think there's more to it. And I'm not apologizing or giving an explanation or certainly not directing any other way towards government officials where it's well earned. But I also can imagine it's a really terrible job to be in, to be the Federal Reserve Chairman. And I don't think there's making it everybody happy or even most people happy in that position. So I think there's multiple factors at play. The downside is in the meantime, we have elected representatives that are continuing to spend and creating a situation that is uncomfortable for our own citizens. And that's something that we can all, you know, voice concerns about or to, and hopefully that this is a year to do that. And I'm not to say to vote one way or another, but to everybody make their voices heard about the situation that they're seeing and witnessing, and take action however you see fit in order to make the situation better in your own world.
And before we go on to that, because I'd like to go further into the subject with you and everyone else, anybody else who wants to join, just simply request to speak. We'll be more than happy to punch you up on the board here and get you in here. We're going to keep the show to a tight hour because of the technical problems with X that we've been experiencing. I apologize for that, folks, but for some reason, Elon doesn't like to have you go over an hour unless you're one of his favorites, and there's audio distortions which occur when you hear the MP3, and we apologize for that. We're working on a workaround for that now. MacroEdge.net. I repeat, MacroEdge.net. Try the Ozone feature, 2-week free trial, still available. Go there today and sign up for it to read a lot of the papers that we write and publish and to review data you're not seeing elsewhere on the Internet. We're not trying to say that we're right. We're trying to say that we have an alternate point of view that should be taken into consideration for your investing decisions. The St. Louis Fed did a commercial real estate overview on May 30th. Mr. A, and I got to tell you, I looked at that and I saw what's coming up next week, and then I looked at the headline today about the private equity deals on Bloomberg. It was at 6 o'clock tonight, conveniently. U.S. pensions vie with Gulf funds for first shot at PE deals. I'm extremely nervous about this because CalPERS and other pension funds are now pushing to get into the private equity deals, which often means commercial or residential real estate, et cetera. And I'm wondering, isn't that what we did back in 2008, where we got pension funds hooked into large real estate deals that just imploded nationwide? I mean, maybe I'm getting old and forgetting things, but the way I remember it was we had a lot of pension funds getting a lot of trouble, including the UAE, the United Automakers, because they said, hey, UAW said, hey, let's put our money into real estate. It never goes down. And here we are again doing the exact same thing in an unregulated market in dark pools where the exposure and risk is often parked offshore beyond the supervision of the Fed and the FDIC and the SEC.
You're not wrong. And allow me to clarify that your memory is spot on. That's exactly the way I remember it. And that's exactly the way that I have studied and read it. You're right. We're doing it again in a different way with a different name, but it's still the same idea and it's still the same concept. And one of the things that we're facing, again, some of these pension funds are guaranteed. So if there are losses, as taxpayers, we're already on the hook for them, just like FHA mortgages. If they go bad, we've already promised that we will make people whole on that, lenders. So if something goes down there. Downside is we've determined that there are bailouts for certain industries and certain categories. And I don't know. I don't know if we ever really learn. We just kind of change the rules or change how it looks. But at the end of the day, the cycles wind up seeing a lot of the same stuff over and over again.
That's what's concerning me, because I just posted that article up for everyone to read on the MacroEdge thread. If you're following MacroEdge on X, we start a thread underneath the radio posting, and we post some of the links and stories. This co-investing idea from Bloomberg, it hit me the other day because I'm driving to the middle of the state to see a client, and I hear them bragging about the number of CLOs that were issued. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with that term, you can watch The Big Short, get the great explanation, collateralized loan obligation. The derivatives follow the CLOs, folks. That hasn't gone away. It's all been moved to dark pools, dark markets, where you really don't have a lot of supervision over that, versus before it was very publicly observable where you could see what was going on in the markets. I used to track the various indices live every week on my radio show back in 2007, 2008. That's why I think they took it all off. They don't want you seeing what's going on behind the scenes. And the worst part about it is it's not unstable as far as it goes on a normal operating basis, as long as prices are going up and demand is there. No one seems to model for a sudden collapse. And Ulysses, I'm looking at this, and I don't think people understand there's a limit to affordability, not just in real estate, but also for credit, for autos, et cetera. I'll give you a quick story, and I'd like to get your take on this. Walt Disney World food prices have soared 61% in the last 10 years, according to the New York Post. It doesn't seem that bad, 6.1% per year. However, the majority of that increase has happened in the last 3 years. And one more story for this to follow up, and this is where it's going to impact us. From Channel 13 in Tampa, Disney trips lead to debt for almost 50% of parents with young children. We're talking not a little debt to take a trip to Disney World to entertain the little kids. We're talking people taking on debt levels of spending $4,000 and $5,000 on their credit cards that they have to pay off in installments over a long period of time. So you're adding that kind of expense onto everything else. And now we have interest rates on some credit cards as high as 31%. Not a good situation for the American consumer to make this quote-unquote strong rebound that we keep hearing about on the bubble visions in the second half of this year.
Yeah, 31% interest, that sounds horrific, especially to go to Disney World. It's part and parcel of how our government has run monetary policy for the last 54 years, basically. Every cycle, I don't think it's even considered, really. It's just restart the cycle, access to credit, access to reinvestment. So whether it's in 1977 creating mortgage-backed securities, whether it's creating the adjustable rate mortgage in 82, whether it's legalizing mortgage-backed securities in 84, to the cleaning up in 89 of creating the Resolution Trust Corporation, to creating the ability for banking conglomerates to merge with insurance companies in 98, to what we got in the GFC and where we're at now. These are the things that the government does, and they are our cycles. So as we see access to credit dry up, we are going to see more than likely, we're going to see government policy to attempt to spur and restart that cycle. I don't know that once the employment situation starts to deteriorate, depending on how badly or how rapidly it does, that it's going to be a quick or easy fix. The downside for people is especially 31% interest, right? The world is used to ZERP, right? Zero interest rate environment. So they're used to low credit costs. And now the credit cost is, it's still below the 50-year average, but it's somewhat higher than where it was, that there's potential for it to cause even more damage as people need access to more credit and to refinance from real estate to their personal debts, and that is what we're facing right now. And that's kind of the situation that we're looking at behind the scenes, saying this doesn't seem good because if rates don't drop, you know, unemployment's picked up, and we've added a whole lot of risk to the system.
I love providing these little side stories because of my travels. And I'm, folks, I don't fly like I used to. Believe me, it's a good thing I don't, because my hair, I would have less hair than I do now, and I'd pull it all out. But I noticed that something at Publix, which is the major grocery store in Florida, for those of you who don't know, I was watching two kids, I'd say early 20s, cashing their paychecks yesterday, and they're standing in line. The young lady goes up, hands the ID, does her thing, gets her cash. The gentleman, young, average, probably lower middle class kid, hands the stub and the check attached, said, "Which one do you take?" I think the lack of financial education in this country is going to make it extremely difficult for all of these markets to recover, even in this consumer-based economy, because people don't understand that to obtain credit and have money, there are some checks and balances that occur, and there's no education process for that. And I'm afraid that if you're looking at a home mortgage, I'm one of those people that realtors, sorry for those of you in the room that are realtors, and my friends online here in Macro Edge, and the person at the car dealership, hey, I read an entire contract front and back, all the way through, and I'm the little jerk that has the sticky notes, the little stickers that you put on there with the arrows, and I put it on every page. When I go through those contracts, if there's a question, it goes to my lawyer, and if it's an auto dealership, I won't buy the car. I won't deal with it. It's not worth the time, trouble, or effort. If you're going to sit there and not answer my questions straight up, I feel the same way about a real estate deal. I'm not going to go near it. We have kids who don't understand this. They just sign on the bottom line and think, okay, if I sign here, I can buy this. It's affordable each month, so I'll take care of it. And they don't understand the consequences. One of my vendors has an employee upside down in their car. They can't afford it any longer. The bank told her to put it on Carvana and try and sell it. We're already at that level where repossessions are getting at ridiculous heights, folks. Yet you're not hearing about it in the media because of an election year. I don't know what to tell you guys. I really don't. Oh, and my favorite Kalani is on board. Kalani, what do you think about all this? Hop in, sir.
Can you guys hear me?
We can hear you. You sound great.
Hey, you know, as you know, John and Mr. Awesome, I'm in agreement with all the things you folks are pointing at right now, but I come at it from a different place sometimes. I think a lot of what we're seeing in the economy and society and markets right now has to do with adjustment to higher interest rates. So, you know, if you look back at the last 20, 25 years, interest rates were artificially kept way too low for way too long. That started with Greenspan, with the LTCM crisis in, I think, what was that, 98, 97, something like that. Lowered interest rates really fueled the dot-com bubble. Every time they've tried to raise interest rates since then, and there's been multiple times, the markets had a little tantrum or tizzy fit, stock markets specifically, and they've lowered rates. So for all intents and purposes, we've had ZIRP 80, 90% of the time for the last 20-some-odd years. Now, all of a sudden, we get Jerome Powell, and he actually raised rates faster and more than any Fed chair in history. I think. I'm not sure. But, obviously, more than anyone expected. Now, when you look at the market, I mean, what he's looking for, I think, is a change in behavior. We haven't seen change in consumer behaviors or behavior in general at all since he started doing this, you know, 18 months plus ago. And when you look at the markets, you know, the companies and the indexes like the Russell 2000 that are most exposed to higher interest rates, they're the ones struggling. The Russell 2000 hasn't confirmed what's happening in the Dow or the S&P 500, especially the NASDAQ. The large corporations are a lot less exposed to higher interest rates because they locked in long-term debt before this happened. So, you know, when you really look at how this is playing out, of course there's a lag. The big boys haven't had to adjust their behavior. The small companies and individuals are starting to because they realize the Fed's not lowering interest rates this time. That has to play out. And, of course, there's a lag. But, you know, I think you folks have been hearing me say for quite a while, higher for longer until something breaks. At some point, something will break. And maybe we're close to that point now. I don't know. I think we are, but that's just an opinion. But, you know, that's my take. It's about interest rates. It's about changing behaviors that are really, really embedded. And these are bad behaviors.
I agree with you, but I think that the flaw in the Federal Reserve's thinking, and I think the flaw in most economists' thinking, and boy, I'm going to hear about it from my friends online, is that you can use interest rates to manipulate behavior. It worked once in an economy that was at extremes of 16-17% inflation. Now we're at a point where you have people who have been reconditioned because of the behavior of the authorities that they will always get rescued for poor financial decisions, be they in business or personal life, that it doesn't matter what the interest rate is. As long as my monthly payment is within my budget, be it a commercial real estate venture, a residential real estate venture, or a credit card or auto loan, they think somebody's going to come around and bail them out. And I'm fearful of what the consequences of that will be when it does hit the proverbial fan.
I don't disagree, but that's a ZERP mentality. That's the problem.
I want to just chime in on that because I think you're right. They're looking for a change of behavior, and rates are the tool that they have to use. To the point that they are expecting a bailout, and John being concerned about what happens when things get difficult, I think that's ultimately what we're going to find out. Whether it's individual Americans that, if they're not being financially prudent, or if they don't have the ability to, much like we've seen in the extensions of some non-performing loans, everybody will extend as long as they possibly can. How long can everybody extend is ultimately the question if rates and the situation doesn't change.
Well, I'm going to go with this because I think that rates are not the only tools that they have. They could lay the law down to the major banks, the money center banks, and say, look, we're not going to bail you out anymore for a while. You're going to have to eat some losses and participate because the Fed's already lost hundreds of billions of dollars in this and their venture, and they should be liquidating their MBS holdings and shifting it back to the federal government. But now you look at the federal government, without the federal government backing the real estate market, where would the housing market be today? So we have no ability by manipulating interest rates to force a change in behavior. Everybody wants their McMansion. Nobody cares if their McMansion costs them $30,000 down and $2,200 a month plus another $1,000 for insurance and stuff. They think, okay, I can afford $3,200 a month, no big deal. But they never take into account that prices are not stable and they could rise, especially in an environment where the government wants to promote liquidity at all costs across all income spectrums, regardless of financial education, and create the inflationary environment which causes higher interest rates in the first place.
I agree with what you're saying. I think what we're seeing is for 20-plus years, the Fed incented the wrong behavior until Jerome Powell came on. And don't get me wrong. I'm no fan of Jerome Powell for other reasons. But he's been firm on raising rates and stayed there. A lot of people haven't had the cojones to do that. All of the things you talked about, you know, people not wanting to work, all of the symptoms that we're seeing, that's a result of the wrong incentives in our both our, in our economy and in our society.
110%, and I'm scared to see this because now we're using the AI bubble, and I noticed there's a guy with a halo of Apple Bear. I love that because I 110% agree. I think that Jobs is yelling from hell at Tim Cook right now. What they have done with this AI bubble is created a myth that we've got the latest, greatest thing. Try our orange-flavored ice cream. It's the greatest thing you ever had. When in reality, there's no deliverable results. There's no taste. There's no flavor. And it's inflating more assets with no real purpose other than to keep large funds and, sadly, try to save some of the pension funds that made malinvestments in the last bubble. They're trying to bail out pensions which invested poorly 20 years ago, 15, 16 years ago, 10 years ago, by inflating stock prices and bond prices, and the end result is going to be there's going to be a crash. And I'm getting a I'll be the first to say it, and I'm going to say it again. I'm not going to go Harry Dent on everyone and say anything insane like an 86 to 90% crash in the markets, but the risk of an equity correction of great severity this fall or this winter is increasing with each day of these new highs and this poor technical structure of the markets. Add in a failing consumer, a deteriorating real estate market, and guys, I'm open to comments. What do you think is going to happen? Uh-oh, did I lose everybody? Okay.
No.
Sorry.
Well, right, there's different avenues, right? If we hold rates, unemployment goes up, and there are no attempts at reset, then we're probably going to see a bout of deflation, and it's going to be uncomfortable for a few years. Even if they respond and they don't respond in the right way or in the wrong fashion, most like we saw in GFC. But to your point, if we stimulate, we drop rates, we hand create bailouts, then I think the inflationary situation is going to render this country much different and less recognizable than what anybody wants it to be if we continue with the pace of incentive that we created post GFC. That created an inflationary bout that we haven't seen in decades. Maybe one of the worst that we've seen in this country. And I don't think anybody wants to live through the 5 to 15% price increases every single year. And quite frankly, I don't think a lot of people can live through that type of inflationary episode. We've seen it happen in other countries, and it's not nowhere that you'd want to live. We'll put it that way.
I hear you. Mr. K, I'd like to get your take real quick before we close the show out. What usually happens at the end of these speculative bubbles? I haven't seen it this bad since the dot-com era. What is your take on the end result from this? Kalani? Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. A lot of this reminds me of 2000, to be honest with you. You mentioned that at the beginning of this broadcast. I think I've shared with the smaller group before. You know, I was managing equity and options trading desks in 2000. There's definitely elements of the dot-com crash or the build-up to the dot-com crash and the great financial crisis that we're seeing. I think that's because this is a much broader-based bubble. I don't know. I think the longer the dislocations and things that don't make sense and greed and speculation and froth that we see every day now, the longer that continues, the more violent the correction will be. And it's continued for quite a while now. I mean, when you look at every valuation metric that there is, this is one of the most overpriced markets of all time. I think only probably 1929 when you look at most standard valuation metrics, only 1929 really exceeds the extremes that we're seeing now. It's scary. Anyone who says that they're not concerned is either crazy or not looking at the real data.
100%.
It's anyone's guess, I guess, is what I'm saying. I mean, I think bad things are coming. I just don't know when, and I don't know if anyone says they know exactly when or exactly how it plays out. They're not being honest, because it's different a little bit every time.
Claudia, thank you so much. Mr. Awesome, Ulysses Awesome, thank you so much. And everybody who's participating tonight and listening, we will clean this audio up, get it posted up as an MP3, hopefully by tomorrow or Sunday night via YouTube and on the MacroEdge.net website. I'll close out by saying this. A lot of people speculated back in the day, the olden days, that there is no way that we could see a crash in the stock market and that the new technology, like AI, was the future. It was a little company that most people under the age of 30 have no clue about, but it was the largest powerhouse of its decade. That company was called Radio Corporation of America. And when it died, it died. And when it crashed in 1929, it took a lot of investors with it. Be careful. Watch your six. Pay attention to what you're investing in. And most of all, listen to alternative viewpoints. Everyone hyped Apple up to all-time highs this week based on AI, quote-unquote, artificial intelligence that's already incorporated in my 2.5-year-old Android phone from Samsung. Folks, sometimes what you hear in the media, sometimes what you see as far as performance, isn't reality. Keep that in mind, because there's always someone looking to take your last dollar. For MacroEdge Radio at MacroEdge.net, don't forget to go there and sign up for the 2-week free trial if you're not already a participant to read our exclusive articles and data presentations. MacroEdge.net. This is John Galt speaking. Good night to everyone.